Hello, hello. You're listening to the Goggler Podcast. Ian Bahir and Uma with you. And this week we are traveling the world. We are going to Mexico to talk about Tragic Jungle. Then we're going to Canada for the final season of Kim's Convenience before finally going to Jakarta and New York for a brand new Indonesian movie called Ali dan Ratu Ratu Queens. We're still stuck in lockdown over here in KL, so all we're doing is staying at home and watching things on streaming. Yeah. How has it been for you guys? We've been extended another 2 weeks, and it doesn't look like it'll end there because the numbers are still extraordinary.
Yeah, I don't know about you guys, but I'm mentally, what's the word I'm looking for? I'm mentally preparing myself for September, August, whatever that September I think it is.
Yeah, when they publish the plan, the current plan for getting out of it, it's like September, October is phase. The next, like, they're introducing phases when they've already used phases. You can't use the same word for different terminology. Stop! Don't do that.
Yeah,
we're already going to vaccination plan phase four, where they're getting to phase three, which I think I would be in, but never mind that. So September is phase four where things can open. So wake me up when September ends.
Hey.
Yeah.
But you know what it means is that we have to rely on a lot of streaming content, because obviously we have no idea when cinemas will be allowed to reopen. That's usually the last thing to get approval. So we don't know when we're going to be able to watch Fast 9 or Quiet Place Part 2 or even Black Widow for that matter, right?
No, we do. We're watching it. We're watching Fast 9 on the 25th of July. The cinemas will open on the 24th of July. That's why the King of Malaysia and the Council of Rulers, they were like, open parliaments, open cinemas, Fast 9 must not be avoided.
That's exactly what they wanted, right?
Yeah.
Because, you know, the Sultan of Johor is a big car fan, and he's like, I need to watch this movie.
You know what these sultans are all about? Family.
Oh!
Hey! Ba-doom. All right, let's get into, I guess, today's show. We'll kick things off with Tragic Jungle. This one was I want to see a random movie that I kind of came across on Netflix. I knew nothing about it going into it. And I sat down and watched it. It's about an hour and a half. It's incredibly art house, incredibly slow. But I found myself strangely drawn to this film. And okay, so I'll give you the log line of the movie. It's about a woman who is on the run from an arranged marriage, and she finds herself in the jungles of Latin America. And it's set in the 1920s. And I want to call it a horror supernatural thriller, but not.
I thought you were going to finish the whole log line, which was, to escape an arranged marriage, a woman flees into the depths of the main jungle where untamed nature merges with the human and the supernatural. And I think, yeah, even that the first half of that is like, no, that's not it.
No,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And it kind of builds on a Mayan myth, and I don't know how to pronounce it. Is it Xtabe? It's this female demon in Mayan myth who is said to lure men into the jungle to their deaths, right? And that's kind of this underlying thread throughout the film.
I don't know. It feels more like just a theme. Other than the absolute final shot of this film, I didn't feel any supernatural here at all. So I'm not sure why the supernatural was quite prominently mentioned in the logline, though.
It's a lot of things, and I think there's a lot of potential in it. And I think it was, I think, because at one point I saw the glottal stop? Is that what they call it? The X at the beginning of a word? So I think it's Stabe, I think it was the, because I was
Stabe,
listening out
right?
for it. I was listening out for it at one point, because it's like, I'm seeing it in the subtitles going, I need to figure out what this is. But at one point I'm like, is this Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs?
Yeah, I thought of that.
Because I was thinking it's a little bit like that. And then there's also, like, you know, in a shitty way, it's not quite this. This is not me making this complaint, but it could be seen as, you know, the corrupting wiles of a woman on a group of men who are perfectly happy in the jungle on their own without her. You know, that's, you know, it's like one of those fairy tales. And
yeah.
Then, but it's also like this idea of a vengeful spirit taking the form of someone and doing stuff. But none of those hang together, because there's more than seven of them. What was the second one? I've already forgotten. The vengeful spirit thing is like, why these men? Why do these men deserve that? Is it because they're cutting up rubber trees? The rubber trees are still living, so it's not like they're logging or something. So
and even so, it shouldn't be these men. It should be the colonials who are making them do it, right?
Right. This asshole English guy gets. I mean, his again. Maybe that's the point. Is that another thing? Is that like the English came here and made us all fight with each other? Because it's like it's black guys who are working. They call the English, but the rival rubber crew. It's rubber, right? It's gum rubber.
Rubber. Yeah.
The rival crew they come against. They call them the Englishmen, but they're all black guys who are God knows from where. You know.
Yeah. Yeah,
they could be African guys working for the English man brought over with him, or they could be, you know, from Jamaica, or they could be indentured slaves themselves. You don't get that detail. So the white guy gets away with it scot-free. Well, you know, he seems to want to commit a lot of sins. He seems like he's not in it much, but he doesn't seem like a nice guy.
No, he just wants to shoot everything he sees, pretty much. You're right. I think I enjoyed the ambition of the film, and also just because I had never seen anything like it. Like, I'd never seen anything address these or this part of history in this part of the world. Maybe I'm not watching enough Latin American movies, but I remember reading a book a long time ago, maybe about 10 years ago, about the history of chewing gum. And it was a really fascinating book, which I knew nothing about. Like, I did not know chewing gum came from the Mayans and the Aztecs, right? And of course, it talks about British and Americans completely exploiting the economy of that part of the world. Cutting down all of those trees and then just leaving them to rot, right? And I think that this movie tries to bring in all of these various elements. It was also interesting hearing Mayan being spoken.
Yeah.
That was interesting that it decided to go with just switching from Mayan to English, Spanish, I think, as well, right? Or was it Portuguese? Spanish, I think it was, yeah.
Spanish. Yeah. And I think you're right, Ian. I think there is its ambition exceeds its grasp at certain points, but also watching this movie, it kind of made me think of how, you know, even locally in a Malaysian side, this idea of these jungles, these myths, these supernatural ghosts, these are all bits of folklore that we haven't necessarily seen translated, like really fascinating folklore that we haven't seen translated into film.
Oh, it made me think a little bit about the Pontianak movies,
right? Yeah,
in a way. I mean, but there's an element of that to it, but I think we talked earlier about it being arthousey. It does feel arthousey in that unfocused, dreamy way. Like, I'm sure it's all done. It's not like they're just pointing a camera at the jungle. There's a beautiful shot of, is it Jacinta? Is that his name? Jacinto? He's like just standing there as the donkeys pass him by. And it's just like, it's almost leaving him there. And like, there is most of the shots of this is just people sitting in the jungle or close shots. Close shots of the boss man, particularly looking creepy with his hat. But it just didn't seem to come together in a way that I was left thinking about it in the long term. I won't be like coming back to this. You know what I mean?
No, I agree with that. I think I enjoyed it in the moment. And you're right about not just pointing the camera at things and leaving it there, because I think the way the director frames her shots, I really love them climbing up, the shots of them climbing up the tree and tapping the sapodillo, the rubber trees, right? And that was...
Yeah.
Both frightening and very, very cool to watch as well.
I think I'm with you, Ian, on this. I don't think I'll remember this movie. I don't think I'll remember having seen this movie because I don't think it left me with too much of an impression. The problem is this feels like an art house movie, and it has the same issues personally for me. A lot of art house movies do that. I don't care, I guess. I'm not sure what I'm supposed to be rooting for, interested in, noticing, you know. I just don't get it. I think there's a I don't know if it's a lack of focus, but I just, this movie does not stay with me.
I didn't get the motivating thought. Like, about three quarters way through, I started thinking along those Snow White lines, things like that, and thinking, oh, okay, this is going to be an interesting parable, or they're going to say something. But by the end of it,
they didn't do any of that.
It didn't really seem to settle on what the message of the film was. Don't go in the jungle, I guess.
I guess.
Stay the fuck out of the jungle.
At the beginning, there was... I mean, it starts off with a very sort of clear thing, right? This woman is trying to run away from this thing. And then they cross the river. They finally go from... I think they went from Mexico to British Honduras, I think. Or was it the other way around? And the movie just sort of like abruptly stops. And then it just sort of meanders along with the Mexican rubber tappers or gum tappers, and them then deciding to then go back across the river, but never quite. It's just like, okay. I don't know. I just felt really weird. I just didn't think about this movie very much.
I think with a lot of art house movies, it feels like it's the opposite of what we always complain about, in that these movies can use a little more exposition. It always feels like they have a script and then they go, you know what? Let's cut out all exposition completely.
No, but it also feels like one of those things where there's too much of there's too much trust in the audience. That thing of like, oh, they'll find their way. The audience will get their own meaning from this movie, and there's sometimes that's cool, but sometimes it just feels a little unfocused.
There weren't the signposts to let us find the meaning, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Didn't quite have those big signposts. Like there was, like I said, there was a few that seemed to be branching off into certain areas, but the end of the film is very clear about, it kind of establishes what has been going on. Like you have an idea then that what that's the nature of the threat.
Yes. Yeah.
But that's not in any way explained really, or that's like why these people, it's not like, you know, it's not like they ran over that fisherman on the way home from the prom party, or they threw that kid in the lake. Like, what's the inciting incident isn't clear.
Yeah, or they desecrated a grave or something.
Yeah, or they built a housing estate on an Indian burial ground. None of this is real.
Well, it feels like in this case, the inciting incident is men as parasites, right? Or men as exploitative with regards to the jungle, with regards to women, whether it's the British, the Americans, or even the people who are actually chopping down these trees, right? Or tapping these trees. But you're right. I mean, it just feels like we're not having an inciting incident removes drama and conflict, right?
Yeah. Mm. Still, very interesting it got to be on Netflix, though.
No, yeah. And I think that was, it kind of popped up on one of those featured spotlight things, and it kind of showed up on my feed. And I was like, I don't know what this is. And
yeah.
I just kind of clicked play. And what was interesting also is that they didn't even bother with an English title, right? When you watch the movie, it says Selva Tragica. And so it feels like a Netflix acquisition directly from Latin America or Mexico, and they just plonked it on the service to see how it would do. I'd be interested to see how their local audiences react to something like this when they have a lot more context of the history, the mythology, the folklore behind all of that, right? And whether the lack of exposition there doesn't matter to them. But for a foreign audience, I can see why. Yeah, combined with the fact that it's so seriously art house.
It feels very stylistically in that sense. I mean, it did premiere at the Venice Film Festival. So
that tells you everything you need to know.
That tells you.
But it would have played very differently in the cinema as well.
You're right. I think it would have played a lot differently in the cinemas. But I think for me, just to double down on what you guys were talking about, what Uma was saying earlier about how this is surprising to be on the service. I think people should watch it. I think if you're a fan of cinema...
World cinema.
Oh, world cinema. No, but if you're a fan of cinema, you should catch world cinema. You know, these are the kind of movies we never get here. And I think it's always good to sort of expand your horizons, even if you don't like it, but people should watch it just to get a different idea of you know, cinematic language. I think it's really, really interesting.
Yeah. And it is a unique cinematic language as well. Tragic Jungle, you can catch it on Netflix. If you do, we really want to know what you think about this movie. So reach out to us on all of our social media feeds, GogglerMY, also podcast@goggler.my if you want to send us an email. And you can text us on the Goggler hotline, 012-524-5208. We also managed to sit down and catch all the episodes of season 5, the final season of Kim's Convenience. We were big fans of the show, and we have been for a long time. And so it came as quite a shock when the show was suddenly canceled, especially since it had already been given a renewal order for season 6. That said, watching these episodes I found them still quite fulfilling, even though the series ends a little abruptly. It was just nice to be back with my friends again, especially when you're in lockdown. And that's exactly how I see every season and every episode of Kim's Convenience. It's like hanging out with friends and family. There is something so wholesome and life-affirming about the show that, you know, no matter how you feel, watching an episode seems to make you feel better.
Slight digression. I don't know. Did you see during the E3 video games conference, there was a wholesome video games stream?
No, what? Really?
Yeah, there was a strand of games that were just wholesome, that were just like, you know, cuddly, chill out, relax games you can play that don't involve violence or anything like that.
Because the world is like, this is what you need right now.
Yeah, but you know, like, you know, wholesome is now a genre. So, you know, yeah, it's the same for TV as well. We kind of didn't mention the fact that, like, before we got to see the show on Netflix, there was an awful lot of stories that came out about the production of the show. And I felt that I don't know whether because we mainlined the previous seasons, so the shorter episodes and, you know, having a never... It seems like when you start a series, you have a never-ending amount of episodes to watch. I don't know whether knowing that the lady who plays Oma and Jung were very vocal about the criticisms of the series, that they felt that there wasn't any Koreans in the actual writer's room, yeah, that they felt that they had to step up and correct the food that was used because otherwise, yeah, it would have been incorrect. And that guy played Jung said that they actually had given some of the scripts where they got them early because of coronavirus. They were racist when they got them and they had to adjust that. And generally it's not the job of actors to do that. But watching the show, I think that did color my expectation of the show. Like, I was, those 20 minutes before were 20 minutes of fun, but now I was like, why is this an episode of Kim's Convenience? Especially knowing there's so few left. You know, things like the ghost sweater. It's like, this could be any show. This could have been an episode of Seinfeld. This could have been an episode of Friends. And we're at this point where I wanted to see more of them just like, I don't want to see the handy guys messing around a bit, like, you know, being screwing around with the party at Shannon's. I wanted to see Appa and Jung hopefully work through their things, or more on Janet. Like, there's a thread that they start to pull on with Janet and what she got up to in Tanzania that just is gone.
I think that was probably a function of thinking you had a season 6, right? And potentially a season 7.
I don't know about that, because like the stuff in Tanzania, it was brought up and then it was literally dropped for the last couple of episodes. I just didn't feel like there was no follow through.
But that's always been Kim's though. Like even with her relationship with the doctor guy, it's brought up in one episode, it's not addressed for 7 episodes, and then it's brought up again like 8 episodes down the line. And so they always seem to take their time. Like, even with Jung, like, we had absolutely no idea what the problem with Jung was for almost like a season, a whole entire season.
No, but they didn't ignore the Jung situation, right? They mentioned that there was a Jung problem, but they never, I mean, yeah, you're right. They didn't sort of tell you about what really got him kicked out, but at the end of the day, they did talk about how there is a problem with Jung and Appa.
But for the most part, I find that Kim's Convenience takes a very Simpsons-esque approach in that every episode is almost a reset.
Long-term view.
Yeah, every episode is like a reset, but at the same time, there are some threads that they keep going back to.
Right.
But for the most part, they want you to be able to jump in at any point and enjoy the show, right? So it's not serialized television like we used to.
Yeah, but I think that the leads, though, had become so entrenched in their characters and so watchable that after 5 seasons, they could have switched it up. And like, I mean, they did get rid of Pastorina's only in 1 or 2 episodes, right? They only have, you know, the regulars who come in and out, there's fewer of those again.
There's fewer now, yeah. Enrique shows up maybe twice.
But like I said, I think at this point, the original story that we heard was that Ince Choi, is it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, at one point, Ince Choi supposedly took a back seat and then came more involved. But like, at some point, they could have switched over to like just actually being 80% the family and the stuff that's going on there. But not just like slapstick random crap, you know, not like prank war for no reason. You know what I mean? Some of that stuff felt like it could belong in any show. Whereas this, again, maybe it's just because the end was in sight for me. Whereas this show, it felt like, okay,
why are we here? Why are we wasting time here?
Why are we here? Why are we wasting time? Exactly.
I mean, for me, like, a perfect example off the top of my head is that tennis episode. Sure, it's a funny doubling down on Appa and Amma, but it didn't move the story along. It just felt like, why are we here? Why are we still here talking about golf clubs? And
I loved that episode because for me, that was a Kim's episode. Like, it was such a Kim's episode, even the resolution of it, even them not getting caught in the end of that episode, like not being found out, was a very Kim's way of handling it.
Yeah, but I thought it's a Kim's way of handling it, but the situation itself feels like it's cookie cutter. You know what I mean? It's like, oh, we're going to try and get into somewhere else. We're going to try to have airs above our station. And I actually, that kind of annoyed me at that point. I was like, this, it's, when you say it doesn't move the story, it's even not about the story. It's like, it doesn't reveal anything. It didn't reveal anything new for me for the characters. It's like, it felt like they were in space. It's like that episode. It's like that. I think I gave up on Bleach when there was a season of the anime where I was a few episodes into it. It's like, this is the weirdest fucking change from whatever was going on the previous season. And it turned out the anime had gotten ahead of the manga. So they invented a storyline that would span 18 episodes or whatever it was that season, and that everyone would be exactly where they were at the beginning of the season with the main story at the end, and it was a new threat. And I was like, hey, nobody got time for that. And that the tennis one, just, I didn't find it that, I found it cringy, and it didn't, that I never felt that way before with Kim's.
It's funny, I think I had that problem in season one because I didn't, I thought the structure of the show was going to be your usual structure of the show, where you'd have a cliffhanger and then you'd pick up. But even if you have a cliffhanger, the first episode of the next season never really picks up on that cliffhanger, right? It's just like life seems to continue as usual for the Kims.
Yeah.
And so I think that kind of, when I approach Kim's, I think that kind of plays on my mind. So I didn't really expect that. For me, it was more a case of the progress of these characters. I got used to the fact that the progress of these characters comes at a very slow pace. So if Janet says something about her future, it's not like it's going, it's not like there's going to be drama, conflict resolution within one or two episodes. Feels like it's just going to take its own sweet ass time while they make jokes about something in between, right? And so in that sense, for me, that felt like a regular season of Kim's. And I think that might have been the problem given it's the last season of Kim's.
Yeah, it's hard to divorce those two things for me, but it's also the fact that after five seasons, the strength of the show is the characters, and having them together as well, and having them, even when they're working through their problems, it's great to watch that. And these actors are all so good.
Which is why I think the last episode was so fucking strong, because I think that's what we wanted, or that's what you wanted from the rest of the season. Like, there is a lot that happens in that last episode. With Shannon, with the family, with Jung, with their future. Yeah.
They managed to have a conversation and storm off and actually come back. It doesn't take 8 years for them, for Jung or Appa to actually say hello to each other. That's great.
Yeah, there's there's growth. Exactly.
Yeah.
But you're right about, actually, now that you mentioned, you're right about certain sitcom tropes that they go back to. And I don't know, I think in another show I would have had a problem with it. So when Appa is shy to hang out with Kimchi, it feels like a very sitcom trope about the old guy being shy to hang out with the young cool guy, right? And I don't know if it's just because I love these characters so much that I enjoyed watching that play out. Like when he's stalking him outside the cinema, waiting for him to come out from watching Parasite, I was like, oh yeah.
And he's bought a nice hat with the money that they found in the back. But I think that worked because that ties into what's going on. That ties into the character. Like the anxiety there comes from Kimchi knowing that Jung doesn't get on so well with his son, with that dad, and everything else there, and the fact that he does, you know, he's a sensitive guy. He'd feel that guilt, and I think that all worked within that context. The house being haunted by a ghost sweater was just like, what? This is like, this is, you know, the throwing the darts at the plot board. You know what I mean? I think that was a fun episode for Gene Yoon, but still, I'm just like,
I was never big on the show the way you guys were, but it became comforting TV to watch, you know, and this sort of new season feels like it's lost a lot of that magic for me. Felt like it lost a lot of that comforting nature, because it felt like there were too many of those episodes of just, why are we here trying to watch them play tennis? Why this the ghost sweater thing just seemed weird. It just
is the ghost sweater Fonzie jumping the shark.
Oh, wait, that's a good question.
Have the Asylum already put out a movie called Ghost Sweater versus Fonzie Shark?
that's the next installment in James Wan's Conjuring trilogy. Ghost Sweater.
I thought you were going to say the Sharknado series.
I'm still sad to see the series go, though. I mean, I would have liked to see these characters for a little while longer, at least. And I think for me, it's just, Everything else aside, I think the biggest resolution, I would like to have seen some resolution between Jung and Appa, like a real resolution.
Yeah. You're not alone in that. Like Simu Liu is also like, I would have liked to have seen that too. You know, you want to see the two of them playing catch in the backyard.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Throw a ball. Come on. But on the whole, I mean, I think as far as, at least for me, five seasons of television, it's a very solid show that still makes me laugh out loud.
I mean, some network just needs, Netflix just needs to swoop in there and just call it fucking Jung's Convenience or something. I don't care. And just get all the cast back and just do the same thing, but just let them write it or get them to get their Korean friends to write it or something. Because it's annoying how, like, it's insane how things get made when you hear about the stories behind it and how like, you know, having to, ideally, yes, people would say like you're acting, it's an easy job or whatever like that, but having to be the cultural sensitivity coach for the production has got to be wearing. And, you know, like we wouldn't have known about the joys of mung bean if, you know, she hadn't told the writers what to fucking make the food. The food was all wrong most of the time. That just, it blows my mind that was happening in a show that showed me so much more about Korean culture than anything else.
And also, you can't just be actors anymore, right? Because the world will take it out on you. You can't just be that person who's spouting out lines. You can't just pass the buck and say, oh, well, I was just doing my job. And so I guess all of them have this added responsibility, weight of responsibility upon them. And I wouldn't be surprised if Netflix has done that. They've done it before with things like Arrested Development. Who knows? They might be doing it with that NBC show that I never see, Manifest. I think I saw the first episode of that. That's very fascinating because it was canned by NBC, but the day before it was canned by NBC, it premiered on Netflix and became number one in America.
Hmm. Right.
And so now people are like, oh, save Manifest. But Manifest at these very, I saw the first episode, very strange MH370 vibes, but with superpowers? I don't know. I don't know what's going on with that show.
Is this the 4400 again? Is that the 4400? No.
It's like the plane goes missing and everyone kind of reappears 5 years later.
Yeah, that was Flash Forward?
No, Flash Forward was when everything stops for a while and like things crash out of the sky. And
what was the one where there was another one? I think maybe it was the 4400 was the people who disappeared and came back. There is another one with a plane disappearing and then people coming back.
Lost?
And it was in the wake of Lost. Don't get me started.
I know. I only bring it up because we had a nice long chat. Well, you guys had a nice long chat about it.
There was in the wake of Lost, there was all those shows trying to come up with that little gimmicky thing.
Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, Kim's Convenience does very well on Netflix globally. So who knows? But at the same time, you know, whether what was very interesting about the cancellation of the show for me was that they didn't even bother going on with new writers and new producers. And so I don't know if the producers and creators have a special rights agreement where only they can do the show or they own the rights completely. And so therefore...
Well, he wrote the play, right?
He did write the play, yes.
Yes.
If what, you know, what you guys have been saying, it's true. And maybe some fresh eyes would have brought something new to Kim's or would have refreshed Kim's for a following season. I don't know, Netflix, balls in your court. We know there are a lot of fans out there, a lot of Malaysian fans of Kim's Convenience as well. So let us know what you thought of season 5. And, you know, maybe we can start a letter writing campaign to
save Kim's Convenience.
Change.org. I don't know.
Yeah, we start sending persimmons to the Canadian Broadcasting Channel.
That's right.
I know it's persimmons.
Ian could not let that sit. He was just like, no, I don't want people to think I'm dumb.
Kim's Convenience is now streaming on Netflix. You can watch all 5 seasons over there. The last thing we're going to be talking about on today's podcast is a brand new Indonesian movie from the director Lucky Kuswandi. It's called Ali dan Ratu Ratu Queens. It was supposed to have a cinema release last year in 2020, but because of COVID, it was all delayed and Netflix acquired it. By the time you listen to this, it will be available to watch on Netflix. It tells the story of a young man, Ali, whose mother leaves him to pursue her dreams in New York. And he's left alone in Jakarta with his father. Many, many, many years later, after his father passes away, he decides that he is going to go seek out his mother in New York. And encounters these 4 aunties who are incredible and they kind of take him off the streets and adopt him and make him a part of their found family. And this is a movie that is incredibly, you know, wholesome and heartwarming. And what I enjoyed most about this film is that it wasn't anything particularly new in that, you know, this is a fish out of water immigrant story that you've seen time and time again in cinema, but there was a nice Indonesian twist and approach to it, which I really, really loved. And also just everyone in this movie was wonderful to watch. There was so much heart in this film. And I think, that was exactly what I needed being stuck in lockdown once again. It was just a really well-meaning film. I had a blast watching this movie.
I mean, you and I wrote the sort of chat. We had a chat about this on the site, Uma, and it's hard for me to say anything about this film without saying bad things about our Malaysian industry, because it's hard to not compare, right? It's so hard to not compare these two films, because Ali dan Ratu Ratu Queens, it's not difficult to do. It's in the sense that there's no car chases, there are no guns, there are no police.
No,
I mean they do shoot a good bit on New York, which has got to have been expensive.
I mean, I looked it up. It's about 2 weeks worth of shoot.
They use it expertly. Like, it feels like they gave it the time.
Yeah, but here's the thing. Like, you don't have to go. The New York-ness of it, the New York aspect of it, is not what really drove this film. It did not. That's not what made me love this movie.
It could have been set in Johor.
It could be Johor. It could have been. They could have gone to Bali.
Nobody goes to Johor to pursue their dreams.
No, but my point is, there's that to say, like, oh, they went to New York, of course, they got money. No, that's not the point. The point is, the story is beautifully crafted, right? It could have been a story about a Penangite coming to Kuala Lumpur. It could have been a story about a Johorian coming to Kuala Lumpur. This story is not difficult to do. It shouldn't be difficult to do.
And yet, so many times it is. Like, it moves at a great pace. No scene lingers longer than it has to. Hello, Tragic Jungle. Everything, like, I was watching it, and I mean, it wasn't that I was losing, the film was losing me. I mean, it also has a very complicated relationship with his mother when he finds her. And that's played very nicely as well. But every scene just moves. And the Indonesian music is great. And, I mean, is this the first movie to use Billie Eilish's I Love You song on it, the track? I was like, whoa, that's one thing to say. That's like, you know, Terry Gilliam getting Sean Connery for Time Bandits. It's like, it's in the script, it says, and Billie Eilish's song I Love You plays, brackets, we know we're not going to get this,
right?
So let's find something like it, or get an Indonesian to do a cover that we can pay, what is it? You can pay cover rights on something, right?
Yeah.
And the actual song's in the movie, and it feels like it was written around it. It works incredibly well. And it shows that kind of the craft and the thought that went into everything. It's one of those things that makes other directors look lazy. Yeah, without throwing the industry here under the bus, Bahir, it is something that makes other movies, like when you look at other movies and there's no establishing shots of shit, or, you know, the characters are just like, well, this person just wanders out of the film. None of that happens here. The characters are well drawn. They all have, they even just down to their outfits. And even though they did the fact that when they have a cute scene where they dress Ali up for an event, and they all dress him how they would dress themselves. It's just a nice little bit of thought into everything.
And you're right about his complicated relationship with his mother as well, because I think that kind of builds on everything that has come before, right? Because clearly the director knows, like, oh, wait, I'm not making the first movie of this kind ever. And so this is not going to be a quest film where he and the four aunties spend the entire 90-minute runtime looking for his mom only to be reunited at the end. I mean, that happens very early in the film. And this is about the consequences of that meeting and the complexities involved in someone leaving her family, finding a new life somewhere else. And then what to do when this boy, this son of yours, comes back into your life.
But also, it's a very human nature, right? There, the mother never leaves the family. So initially there was that, you know, there was that threat of, oh, maybe she left because she didn't want to be here anymore. I mean, it wasn't really something that was said, but there was that sort of underlying tone of of, did she leave because she thought she was better than Indonesia? Did she leave because she didn't want to be in Indonesia anymore?
Well, that's what her judgy family thought.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, that was his judgy family, his father's family, I think it was. Yeah. And but when they do meet, and like you said, Uma, it happens wonderfully early in the film, it sort of changes all that, right? You're now sitting there going, huh, I didn't understand what she was going for. I didn't understand why she left. Now I do. It's not just the simple trope of, I want to be a big star in New York, so I'm bouncing out of this little town.
Well, the reason she left and the reason she stayed are quite different, yeah? And when we first said we were going to do this, I got a little mad at the trailer because it does show him finding her. And I was like, don't fucking do, what the fuck, what are you doing? and actually it turned out that, no, that was perfectly fine because that movie's not about that. And that was great. And the scene in the alley with the trash cans,
right,
which like is just, I mean, even metaphors there is like, ah, yes, she does belong with the trash. Mm-hmm. But even that, nothing is all tied up in a bow at the end as well. Mm. Like there's things left hanging there. There's not quite a happy ending, but there is a happy ending.
But it feels like there's space for growth, right? It feels like these characters will go on and do and, you know, match up or miss out or they'll grow from this almost 2-hour movie that we just watched.
I think one of the cleverest decisions was the whole Times Square thing. You know, Ali gets to spend a day with his mom and they go sightseeing in New York, right? And the director does not play out the montage the way you think he will, because you're shooting in New York. So what do you have to do? You got to do that New York sightseeing montage, Central Park, Times Square. And instead he picks up with them coming out of the subway after they've seen Times Square, get into that fight, which you know is coming, because it always happens after people have a great day out. And then use the montage
that you didn't see.
Like in a flashback sequence, which you didn't see, in a flashback sequence to kind of show you how forgiving the boy is or how blinded Ali is to his mother, right? Yes. Because even after that fight, he's sitting on the subway looking at those videos, and in his brain, none of this is spelled out, but you can tell he's still thinking, my mama, she loves me. She's so great. Mm. And and I thought that was really cool, because that then plays out later, you know, at the scene, this really climactic scene around a dinner table where he has a fight with his four new aunties, which is really, really cool. And you know what we forgot to say? The movie's funny as well. Like the movie is genuinely funny. Like when the aunts find out that the mom shuts the door on him when they first meet after all this time, and they're fucking ready to go crack skulls. Right? Yeah.
You know, as I say in the article, it's that African-American woman of like, hold my earrings kind of situation, right?
Yeah.
They were really going to open a can of whoop-ass on that. And just watching them sort of hustle and bustle. And I think it's both a credit to the performers and a credit to the director in how simply she shot it. It was just a simple wide shot. You see the dining table as they're running around it, picking up their stuff, ready to go. And
Party has to wear a hat at all times.
Has to wear a hat, yeah. I mean, I don't want to use the word competence, because it feels competence. The word competent implies that it was good enough. This is more than good enough. That was a complete excellence in mastery of that situation.
Yeah. Also, the performances. I think I was very impressed with Iqbal Ramadan in the way he played that character, because I was worried when I saw the trailer. Characters like that can be annoying and grating.
Yeah.
Because a lot of times that character just seems to be pulled along, right?
Yes, exactly.
They've got one thing. They want to go to New York, find the mother, and then just get swept up in everything and just sort of moves from set piece to set piece to set piece. Whereas in this one, there's a lot of agency for him. He's going to go and find the mother. He's going to take the train to go and do this. He's going to go and do that. So,
and he is dragged around though a little bit by he's bullied into moving in with these four women. But he has his growth, and he has his like his moments of rage later when he makes his own life. You know, just like Buddy and Elf.
Exactly.
What?
He goes to New York to find his father.
I like that the agency didn't come at the end. Like, it's littered throughout the film. Like, even when he confronts his aunt, on the many occasions when he confronts his aunt about lying to him, you know, when she calls him up and has a go at him for posting the photo of his mother because he's embarrassing the family. I mean, you can see
I was like, fuck that bitch.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You can see that agency build throughout the film, which is just, yeah, it's symbolic of great writing. He didn't just go, oh, okay, let's just do the hero's journey. At the end of the movie, there's going to be one big monologue where he will show how much he's grown, right? That growth happens throughout. And like you said, Bahe, because there's no neat bow, you can see that the growth is going to continue, right? Yeah.
It's basically Ali and Ratu Ratu Queens. Tell me you're a coming of age story without telling me you're a coming of age story.
Correct.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Correct. Yeah.
I do have to say though, the first meal the aunties make him like is a fucking sandwich.
It is. Well,
I was expecting something
like a full-on Indonesian, right?
Well, hang on.
Or even just some warmed up rendang or leftovers, but no, the fucking sandwich. Was it kaya toast? I don't even know.
Hang on. You mentioned rendang. And I have to say, me and my wife were watching it, and I'm like, turkey rendang for Thanksgiving? Fuck, dude. Mm. That's what I want now. Can somebody put together turkey fucking rendang for Thanksgiving?
Also, loving Mia's hoity-toity New York friends who like originally think someone's delivering rendang. And she's like, oh, where's the rendang?
Where's the rendang?
No, sorry, it's the way she pronounced it was so fucking weird. The rendang. Yeah. Have you not got the rendang? I mean, they were supposed to be stuck up bitches, but still.
Actually, speaking of that Thanksgiving scene, I think that goes back to something else, which isn't really kind of expounded upon in the film, but it's told rather implicitly, which is this idea of being Indonesian and being New Yorkers at the same time. And I think that was something that was alluded to really well. Like, they've embraced that culture. They've embraced Thanksgiving as a festival that they too celebrate, but they do it in their own way. And
with hash brownies, is that what those were supposed to be?
Were they hash brownies? No,
I think they had to have. I think that was what was.
Wait, is that why they were tripping on the roof, or were they just overly emotional?
It was the weirdest trip scene I've seen in a movie. Like, I was just like, what are they on? This is no stoner acts like this.
No, not so, only that, but it also feels like that it feels like that moment when people have had too much to drink and they start getting emotional.
Yeah,
they
mentioned to Eva is like, you can't have a slice, you're still underage. So I don't know, maybe it was booze cake? Is such a thing exist?
Rum brownies?
Was it rum brownies? Like, that and the sandwich were slightly inexplicable for me. Also, that guy who runs the halal stand, who is like the best looking, most amazing sounding man ever.
Oh yeah.
His voice is like wet velvet.
You will eat whatever he has to give you.
Oh my God, Uma, that's so disgusting.
But I thought that was, I don't know, maybe it's a Muslim thing, but it was nice to see that, because it was nice to see that there were other Muslims in New York. I'm not saying there aren't any, but...
Yeah, that not all the Muslims are shitty aunties back home. And
yeah, you know.
But that also plays very true to what that's like, right? I mean, I've had situations like that even when I was in the UK, when if I went to a Malaysian restaurant, they find out I'm Malaysian, I get discounts, I get free food.
Yeah, they become
you know, they get so excited, right? So they're like, this one on the house, you try this.
Well, I will say though, that doesn't happen in London. Because they see enough Malayus in London to not want to do that anymore.
It was still exciting in Bristol, correct? Yeah.
Yeah, yes, but it's another thing when that in that same scene, it's the New Yorkness of it as well. There's the black lady who just like gets up in your business in a nice way, and then that works out for you, honey.
Yeah,
that's nice.
Yeah.
I did just say though, they didn't quite avoid the montage. I was watching it and I kept thinking back to there's that one moment in Trainspotting where the action moves to London, and I can always remember. I can't remember the song from the soundtrack, which was like what welded into my Walkman. But like, there's a certain song that plays, and there's the cheesiest fucking like visit London.com montage that plays, and it's like it's completely adrift of the rest of the film. It's like it's not even the second unit shot it, it's the 16th unit seems to have shot it or something like that. We do get that when they land, when Ali lands in New York, you do get that. I'm like, when I see the big, it's this big London, big New York bus or something like that, I was like, yeah, you gotta have that bus shot. It's got to be a reference to Trainspotting 2, where you see the buses and the tourists and all that shit. Trainspotting 1, what were you saying?
For me, you know what that shot was? It felt like Lucky Kuswandi just went, I've always wanted a shot of a New York guy playing a trombone.
In the rain.
In the rain.
I was like, no one busks in the rain. There's no punters.
That was that one super self-indulgent shot in the film. Yeah, we really enjoyed this film. We highly recommend you watch it. It's not often we get movies like this, because there are a few Indonesian movies on Netflix, but not all of them get added, and Malaysians don't actually get an opportunity to watch many Indonesian films. I mean, unless you're signing up for a whole bunch of streaming services, right? So Ali dan Ratu-Ratu Queens is definitely something worth watching this weekend. We want you to check it out. Let us know what you think when you see it. It's impossible to watch movies like this and not feel a little heartbroken every time we see a local production. If you're the same, let us know on GogglerMY. Also, email us, podcast@goggler.my. Don't forget to like this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Tell your friends, tell your family. You can also reach out on the Goggler hotline, 012-524-5208. We've been giving lots of recommendations to people. If you're stuck in lockdown and unsure of what to watch, give us a shout and we will help you out. Thank you so much for listening. This is the Goggler Podcast.
Okay, see you.